Support for podcasts of Medical Monday comes from the hospitals of HealthQuest and HealthQuest Medical Practice, physicians offering primary and specialty health care in private office settings throughout the Hudson Valley, 1-888-525-HQMP or 4767 for appointments.
Good afternoon, everybody. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to the Vox Pop for this Monday, July 9th. I'm Alan Chartok. Support for Medical Monday comes from Saratoga Hospital Medical Group, the multi-specialty practice of Saratoga Hospital with 27 specialty practices and more than 170 providers taking care of their community. SaratogaHospital.org for more. Joining us this afternoon for Medical Monday is Dr. Mark Sanchez of Ellis Hospital. He's here to answer your questions about what? Listen up now, general and robotic surgery. We always get a lot of calls, of course, so get yours in now. The number is 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. Dr. Sanchez, your call's all coming up from the Vox Pop right after this news. But listen, make the call now. You don't want to be scratching your head tonight and say, I should have called. Hello once again. Welcome back to the Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Alan Chartok. Joining us on this Medical Monday to discuss general and robotic surgery is Dr. Mark Sanchez of Ellis Medicine. He's board certified by the American Board of Surgery, born and raised in Rochester, New York. Dr. Sanchez completed his undergraduate and medical school education at the University of Rochester. Now get this, folks, while working as a deputy sheriff, he enjoys educating patients about the anatomy involved in their disease process. Dr. Sanchez believes this empowers them to be an active participant in the decision-making process, improving surgical outcomes. He joined the surgical staff at Ellis Hospital in 2011. Dr. Sanchez, welcome to Vox Pop.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Which job did you really like more? Deputy sheriff or surgeon?
You know, I didn't like writing tickets, so definitely surgeon.
That's great. I'll bet you had that question a few times.
You know, it's funny how many people actually go on the internet and see that before they come in. So, yeah, right. Get that well, almost daily.
If he's good enough to be a deputy sheriff, he's good enough to be my surgeon.
Thank you.
The number to call is 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. You can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. So, Dr. Sanchez, tell us, what is your most frequently performed operation?
Wow, I think for general surgery, the most common operation is probably hernias.
Yeah.
When you're covering the emergency department, you get quite a bit of appendectomies for appendicitis, gallbladder disease.
How do you know when you're having an appendix attack?
You know, appendicitis typically would present with right lower quadrant belly pain. Uh-huh. And unlike other types of pain that can occur in that location, it's usually constant, might have a fever, nausea, vomiting.
So the name of the game is to get in fast, because otherwise you could have a real problem.
Yeah. Yeah. The earlier the better. That definitely makes my job a little easier.
Yeah. Well, and then the other part of your bio that I read is robotic surgery. What does that mean? Is it, you know, something from Star Wars, this little guy out there?
Well, I think the common misconception is that the robot actually does the procedure. The robot is a tool that a surgeon can use to do something more precisely and to get better visualization. So the robot is not doing the operation. It's not as simple as pressing a button and the robot's going to take out your appendix. I use the robot frequently for my hernia repairs. It's very difficult to suture laparoscopically. And so with the robotic instruments having wrists, it makes that job a lot easier. It makes
robotic
it easier to put
having what?
Wrists. So the instruments that you would use laparoscopically are straight instruments. And so if you're trying to tie a knot, just like if you're trying to write a letter, it's nice to have wrists because you can do things with your wrist that you can't do with if you had a cast on your wrist.
Right. Well, we're looking. I'm certainly looking. I live in Great Barrington. I'm coming to Albany every morning in the dark and dank. And I'm waiting for you know, basically my robotic car, driverless car. They take me here. Say, take me to Albany while I go to sleep. Yeah. Do you see a day that we'll ever have you know, robots doing the surgery?
You know, that's an interesting question. I think we're certainly getting closer, but everyone's anatomy is a little bit different.
Yeah.
And I think I always tell my patients, the hard part about what I do for a living is not the technical aspect of that. You could teach a mechanic to fix a car by watching someone else do it and learning those steps. So the technical part is not difficult. It's the decision making. So if you're in the operating room and plan A doesn't work out, you better be able to think your way through and have a plan B and C. And because every case is different, every hernia is different, every abdominal perforation is different, it's nice to you need that human decision-making process. We're not there yet.
Marcus, is everything going well in a way? I mean, you know, I had hernia surgery years and years ago. But then every once in a while, you turn on the television, the mesh has been replaced. They don't like the mesh. Somebody's suing something for somebody. You are dependent on the tools they give you, aren't you?
Right. Yeah. You can fix a hernia without mesh. The downside of doing that is you're taking your weak tissue to begin with, which is why you develop the hernia, and you're pulling it under tension. And so the recurrence risks without mesh are much higher.
Interesting.
The benefit of mesh is that it adds strength to the repair. So we'll talk about it a little later if you'd like, but when you do a robotic hernia repair, the benefit of using the tools from the robot is that you can close the hole in the muscle with sutures first, and then you reinforce it with the mesh.
Yeah. Well, please.
Yeah, in regards to your point about the issues with mesh and a lot of the commercials that we're seeing, that's the number one question. As soon as I use the word mesh, patients get nervous and they say, I saw something on TV and there's recalls on mesh and things. The mesh that we've been using for abdominal or inguinal hernia repairs has been around 20-plus years. It's a material called polypropylene, and it's certainly gotten better with time, but it's very safe. I don't know of any manufacturing issues where mesh is broken or caused issues. I think the majority of problems we're seeing with mesh is if mesh gets infected.
Mm.
And that's a patient-dependent situation. Someone who's diabetic, someone who's obese, smokers, those are all risk factors for infection. So if you develop a wound infection and you have a mesh sitting close by, there's a chance your mesh can get infected.
Yeah. Okay, you ready to take some calls?
Absolutely.
We'll go to Jim in Matamoros for change. Okay, Jim in Matamoros, you're on.
In correcting a ventral hernia, are the tissues involved first surgically debride it? And is the mesh inserted inside or outside the peritoneum? From what you just said, I expect it's probably outside.
Yeah.
And what gauge sutures on the polypropylene would be used?
Yep. So... there's 3,000 ways to fix hernias, and there's not a perfect way to do it. So the technique, whether the mesh is placed on the outside of the muscle or underneath, closer to the abdominal contents, is going to depend on the size of the hernia that you're repairing. We typically do not debride any tissue unless you're there for an infection.
What does that mean, debride?
Debride means removing infected or tissue that could cause problems if you leave it behind. So if someone had a previous hernia repair, for example, and the mesh becomes infected, well, it's a permanent material. That mesh has to be removed, and then you would typically debride some of the infected tissue surrounding the mesh. But for 99% of the hernias that we repair, it's a sterile case, and you don't have to do any kind of debridement.
Thank you very much, Jim. 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. Your chances of getting on now, if you've got a surgical question, are very good. Let's go to Michael in the Hudson Valley. Michael, you're on.
Yes, hi, good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call.
Hi, Michael.
Yes, I have medial epicondylitis in both my elbows. I have had ulnar transposition surgery and debridement in my left elbow already. I'm trying to prevent having to do the same surgery on my right elbow because it's extremely painful. I was just miserable after. For about 3 days, I couldn't even sleep. So I'm just wondering, do you have any recommendations or things? I mean, I'm already seeing an occupational therapist, a hand therapist especially, to do whatever it takes to try to reduce the inflammation. And I'm wondering if putting it in a sling to immobilize it, meaning the right elbow, will help.
It's a great question. A little later out of my area of expertise, that'd be probably a better question for plastics or orthopedic surgery. But I think some general principles in terms of operations exist here. I think the smaller the incisions, the further away those incisions are from the joints, certainly are going to help in your recovery. I think the immobilization part is a double-edged sword. So certainly if you immobilize that area, the early post-operative pain is going to be better. I think then you're going to end up dealing with some stiffness and maybe some physical therapy type issues later. So again, better question probably for your hand surgeon or your plastic surgeon, whoever may have done the transposition. But
Michael, you can't because we're up against the break right here. Thank you for your call. Thanks a lot. Yeah, bye.
Support comes from Villa Veritas Foundation, Kerhonkson, New York, honoring founder Jim Cusack, continuing his work for over four decades and four generations, helping the chemically dependent and their families battle addiction. VillaVeritas.org. Studio KTM Salon Red Hook, specializing in all phases of cut and organic color, from corrective to fashion by stylist Kristen Marquette. StudioKTM.com. Travels with Sarah, organizing private African safaris with authentic tented camps and lodges, accompanied by Africa specialist Sarah Kearns, sarahssignaturesafaris.com. Interim Healthcare, helping people remain at home for 48 years, providing companions, aides, and nurses in the home 2 to 24 hours a day, serving the Capital Region, Columbia County, Glens Falls, and Saratoga, intermhealthcare.com. And from Mother Earth's Storehouse, serving the Hudson Valley with a variety of seasonal items and organic and all-natural foods. MotherEarthStorehouse.com for daily events and cooking demonstrations.
And we're going to go to a question in a minute, but in the meantime, I want to remind you, you're not going to have this opportunity every minute, just on Mondays, and now on surgery. 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. I want to encourage you to call. We'll go to Larry in Cambridge. Larry in Cambridge, your turn. Larry. Hello, Larry.
Yes, hi. Sorry I missed that. Question about a family member who developed immediately after hernia surgery an allergy, and a question of no particular solution was or cause was identified. It could have been the latex. It could have been the anesthetic. I heard you talk about mesh. I don't think that came up. Any suggestions? What causes it?
Sure. Well, there's lots of parts that go into an operation. So typically before hernia repair, someone receives what's called a prophylactic antibiotic. So within an hour of making an incision, through your IV, you get an antibiotic. And if someone had an unrecognized antibiotic allergy, that would probably be the most common reason, and that would usually present as a rash on the chest or on the abdomen. It usually lasts for about 10, 15 minutes in anesthesia, or the surgeon will recognize it, and we can give some steroids and trop, and that typically would go away. I've never seen a patient yet who's had an allergy to mesh. Can it happen? I guess in theory. But if someone had an allergy to mesh, I would expect that rash or whatever was developing around that site wouldn't have resolved. So it could have been any of the anesthetic medications, probably most likely the antibiotic that was given. But as long as it goes away, there's usually no long-term repercussions from that.
Thanks, Larry.
Twice or two recurrences later, and so they basically said, don't eat avocados and don't use latex.
Well, latex is very rarely ever used in the operating room anymore. They've removed most of those things from any of the surgical products that we use.
Okay, very good. Thank you.
Bye. Take care.
We'll go to Ann in Wallkill. Okay, Ann in Wallkill. But before I do, 1-800-348-2551. Ann in Wallkill. Okay, Ann, you're on.
Hi, good afternoon. I just have a question about the whole debridement process. So essentially, how would you be able to find out, what initially caused the infection and what the results are of the debridement? Because I'm assuming that they do some kind of extra testing on on the material or whatever they removed?
Sure. Lots of reasons to get an infection. The typical infection is what we refer to as an abscess. It's a collection of pus under the skin. We don't really know why that starts, but the treatment for that, if it's early enough, you could treat with antibiotics. And if it's involved enough where the skin is red, soft in the center, and we know that there's some fluid or pus under the skin, you do what's called an incision and drainage. A little numbing medication like lidocaine, and then use a surgical blade and drain that pus. There are situations where people will develop skin infections from a cyst. And a cyst is a shell underneath the skin that has this thick white fluid inside. And those folks will usually tell you, I've had a bump somewhere for years. It's never caused me a problem. And then somewhere out of the blue, they develop some redness over that. So the treatment for that's a little different because you don't just want to drain that. You want to remove the cyst wall. But any tissue that is removed during surgery does go to the lab. And usually at the time of your post-operative visit, your surgeon should go over that with you to make sure that there wasn't any unusual tissue or tumors or any, you know, and oftentimes we'll send cultures as well. So we have an idea of what grew and what antibiotics would work with that.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
Take care.
Thanks, Ann. And now on to Jay in Albany, 1-800-348-2551. Jay in Albany, you're on.
Yeah, hi. I don't know if this is a question that you can answer, but I've been having a lot of shoulder pain, and I've been getting the injections, the cortisone injections, and he said sooner or later I'm going to need replacement surgery in my shoulder. I wanted to find out, like, what is the downtime for that, and what would they do for the replacement?
No, I can't help you with that, Jay. Unfortunately, that's for orthopedic surgery.
Okay, thank you.
Sorry about that.
Okay. 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. On to Jim in Rensselaer. Okay, Jim, you're on. Your turn.
Good afternoon, doctor.
Hi.
Good afternoon, doctor. I'm 70-year-old, reasonably good health. I'm wondering about the recovery period from hernia surgery. The hernia is not far from the pubic bone.
Okay, Jim, is it in the abdominal wall, or is it what we call an inguinal hernia, more down in the groin?
Abdominal wall.
Okay. Have you ever had surgery there before? Any incisions in that area?
Yes, long, long time ago.
What was that operation for, do you remember?
That was a hernia, and a slightly different location, maybe an inch or two, 3 away.
Sure. So from what you're describing, it sounds like it's what we call a ventral hernia, which occurs in the abdominal wall. And if you've had surgery before, what I would recommend that your physician or surgeon do for you is you get a CAT scan pre-op, because that's going to tell you how big that defect is that you want to fix, and if there are any other additional defects near it that may change the operation. Now, if the hole's tiny, let's say it's the size of a dime, sometimes all you need to do is make a small incision directly over it, and you patch up the hole. That's quick. That takes 15, 20 minutes, and you're home the same day. If when they obtain the CAT scan pre-op, you have 5 or 6 holes, and surgeons often will call that a Swiss cheese abdomen, that's a little bit more involved. So you'll need a bigger piece of mesh to repair that. And in those situations, that's something I typically would do robotically for the reasons I may have mentioned a little earlier, where you can close those defects and patch up the hole, and the robot with the wristed instruments certainly help you do that. So it really depends on how many holes and how big your hernia is, and that's going to affect your post-op pain and your recovery.
If I had to guess, it's probably about the size of a golf ball, maybe smaller.
Yeah, and if that's the only defect, that's usually a fairly quick operation. But the CT scan helps you measure before, because I never like to go to the OR and try to figure out what I'm going to do after I get there. I want to have a pretty good idea of what I'm going to find. It just makes and the technique's going to change, whether it's open or laparoscopic or robotic. There's no perfect way to do something.
Is a hernia ever an emergency situation?
Yeah. If a knuckle of intestines goes into the hernia, it can cause a bowel obstruction, and that's an emergency. Folks coming to the office where their primary doc found a hernia and they weren't having any symptoms, they'll often ask you, how emergent is this? Is this something I need to do now, or can I wait till after golf season? And it really depends on the size of the defect and what's inside it.
What are you feeling when you have a hernia?
Well, it's been going on for over a year, so I don't think it's strangulating.
No, it's pretty obvious if there's an issue with a knuckle of bowel being in there. It'll cause a bowel obstruction. You'll have tremendous pain and abdominal bloating. So those things don't happen frequently, but when they do, they're fairly dramatic, and that's not something you want to sit home. You want to go right to the ER and have somebody look at that right away.
Thanks, Jim. Okay, and we're now on to Bill in Lake George. The number is 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. On to Bill in Lake George. Okay, Bill, you're on.
Hi, Doctor. I was wondering your experience with hydroceles, an adult male. Is it good to go with a urologist, general surgeon? Who has experience? How many of these jobs would you want somebody to have done before you let them go at you?
Yeah, that's a great question. Urology typically would take care of a hydrocele. Unless,
what is a hydrocele, Doc?
So a hydrocele is a pocket of fluid around the testicle, and it'll create some swelling of the scrotum. I think it's important, though, Bill, that they determine whether or not you have an associated inguinal hernia. Do you get a bump in the groin area that, if you lay down, goes away, or is your problem really related more to the scrotal area?
I had an ultrasound, and it confirmed the diagnosis.
Okay.
As far as that goes.
No symptoms of bulges when you stand or cough or anything like that, a little higher up?
Well, I don't know that. I don't recall that being investigated.
No, most of the time, patients will come and tell you.
That would be a consideration.
Yeah. If it's a straightforward hydrocele, a urologist is probably better qualified. They're going to do a lot more of those. But the surgery, for the most part, is fairly straightforward. You go in and remove the sac and drain the fluid, and recovery should be fairly quick.
And is it fairly common? I mean, would they do like 15 or 20 a year type thing? Or
oh, absolutely.
Hard to say?
No, just like for a general surgeon, inguinal hernias, appendectomies, gallbladders, those are kind of the surgeries we do more frequently. Urologists do tons of hydroceles every year.
So thank you very much, Bill.
Thank you.
Do many gallbladders?
More than we want to. I would say anywhere between 5 and 10 a week, probably.
So what causes a gallbladder attack?
So the gallbladder is a little sac below the liver, and it stores bile, which helps you digest fats. And the typical problem with the gallbladder are that folks develop stones in their gallbladder.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if the stones are sitting in the inner channel of the gallbladder, they're not blocking anything, they can go on for years without ever causing pain or symptoms.
Mm-hmm.
What we typically see, and I was on call last night and came into the emergency department, was someone went out to McDonald's, you have a hamburger, your gallbladder starts squeezing because it's going to help you digest that hamburger, and one of your gallstones gets stuck in the neck of the gallbladder, and that causes tremendous upper belly pain, usually right underneath your breastbone. And folks will often go on for years, and they think they have indigestion because they'll say, anytime I eat, I get pain. But it only lasts for a few hours and goes away, so I've never really talked to anyone about that. Could be a gallbladder attack all along. And so stones going in and out of the neck of the gallbladder is the real cause for that.
Is there a gender issue with your gallbladders? Is it equal between women and men?
No, it seems like we do a lot more gallbladders on women than we do men. The older you get, the more likely you are to have gallstones. And if someone's a little overweight, that's also a risk factor.
So, and why women?
Why women? I don't know.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Hernias are more common in men, and gallbladders seem to be more common in women. We don't know why.
We're off to Gerardo in the Hudson Valley. Gerardo, you're
Hello.
On. Yeah, you're on.
Hello, guys.
Hi, good morning.
Quick question. What do you see the issues with implementing robotics in the surgery room, if there are any for the future and future advancements in, you know, surgery robotics?
Yeah, that's fantastic question. I'm going to be honest with you. I was a late adopter to robotic surgery. And the reason was, I think whenever you implement something new in medicine, there either has to be more benefit than what you're already doing, or it has, if it's of equal benefit, it has to be less expensive. Because if something costs more and it's giving you the same benefit, we're just draining the system. It doesn't make sense to do it that way. I don't do every case robotically, because if there's not a benefit to the patient, or the cost is too high, it doesn't make sense to do that. But what I've been using robotics for inguinal or abdominal wall hernias, because it does things that I can't do laparoscopically. So when you go in and you put in a piece of mesh laparoscopically, which is the small incisions with the straight instruments, it was very difficult to suture that mesh in place. So you were relying on something called a surgical tacker to fix the mesh to the abdominal wall to hold it in place. It's quick, but it's not very sturdy. So,
were you hesitant when you first started using robotics in the surgery room? Is there anything that kind of like made you hesitant about using them?
Yeah, well, you know, you train before you use it. And I'm going to tell you, the leap from open to laparoscopic surgery, that was a big leap. So back in the early to mid-80s when they started doing laparoscopic gallbladder surgery, those operations took 3 to 4 hours. We do them now in 20 minutes because they weren't used to watching a monitor and doing something in front of them with their hands.
Right.
To go from laparoscopic to robotic, the leap is tiny. In fact, robotically, it seems to make more intuitive sense. You know, you almost pretend like you're operating or doing an open operation. When you want to throw a knot with the little Velcro straps that your fingers go into, you just create that same open movement and the robot translates it perfectly. So it gives you better visualization because you're looking into a 3D viewer, so your depth perception is better.
Right.
And it allows for the ergonomics of knot tying and throwing sutures, and that's why I like it for hernias. It's really easy to secure that mesh in place without the tacker.
All right. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thanks a lot. These are expensive, these robots. Right?
Yeah. Well, the capital cost of starting up a robotic program is not cheap. But as long as you're careful about the instruments that you use during a case and not open unnecessary things, new data says that you can keep the cost fairly equivalent to what you're doing laparoscopically. And again, if the cost is equal, but the benefit to the patient is higher.
But what does it cost to buy that robot?
I don't know the answer to that specifically. I'll tell you, it's probably north of $1 million.
Yeah.
Yeah. And just like your television set, you know, 2 years later, there's certainly a newer model that does things that the older model doesn't. But it's an investment, and I think it's important to know for patients that that they don't pay more for robotic surgery. The insurance companies don't reimburse any more to the hospital. In fact, the hospital may buy at a loss using the robot as compared to doing it laparoscopically. But the benefit really is for the patient, and you know, it's important for us as surgeons to make sure that we don't do a case that's significantly more expensive without any benefit.
Now, you mentioned that when you train, who trains you when you go from one thing to another? Where do you go to train?
Yeah, so a big company that handles most of the robotic surgery now is a company called Intuitive, and the robot is called a Da Vinci. There are new competitors coming out in the market soon. But
are these Israeli products?
What was that?
Are these Israeli? I know.
I don't know the answer. Yeah. But they have a training facility in Houston and a training facility in Atlanta. So you go down, you learn just the where things are on the robot, and you do cadaver labs and pig labs. And then, you know, these are all cases that we already do laparoscopically. So you always have a backup option. But like I said, the leap of going from lap to robotic is much quicker because it just allows you to do things so much easier.
How long do you stay there when you go to?
The course is a few days, and then when you come back and you start doing cases, you're proctored by surgeons who have been using the robot for a while to make sure you're safe. And then once they're happy with the outcomes that you have and that you're comfortable with the robot itself, then you get signed off on.
Interesting. Interesting.
Yeah. It's a process. They try to keep it as safe as they can.
But of course, once one hospital gets a robot, everybody needs a robot.
Well, that's where it starts. Yeah. Certainly, you're worried about losing patients to hospitals that have robots. So
let's go to John in Kingston. Okay, John in Kingston, you're on. Hello, John.
Hi, doctor. How are you?
Hi. How are you, John?
Good. I have actually three questions. How do gallstones develop? What causes them? I guess the other one's a statement. I know we just did a big project at NYU in the city that Da Vinci robots are about $1.5 million a piece. And I think I have a hernia. My right testicle has dropped about 2 inches. And I've got a slight pull on the right side, but no lumps. Do you think that's a hernia?
Yeah, so the easiest way to tell whether you have a hernia, you lay on your back, and that bump that you're feeling, you try to push it back in. And if that lump goes away, it's likely a hernia because, you know, it's going to stick out further when you're standing, coughing. That's why you see more hernias in smokers. If they have a chronic cough, that may develop more frequently. So if you can push it back in, it disappears while you're lying down, you're pretty sure you have a hernia. Now, if the hernia is a little bit stuck, that may be hard to do. But a little different than the caller earlier who had a hydrocele, a hernia will usually disappear when you lie down.
Okay.
I had a hernia maybe 2 years ago on the left side, and I knew I had the lump. I could feel it, but this is weird. Just like I said, the testicles dropped, and I'm just wondering if does that normally happen with a hernia?
No, you know, testicles themselves, one may hang a little lower than the other. If you don't feel a lump in your groin area where your hernia was when you had it repaired before, it could just be your normal anatomy, but it's always best to go to your primary, have them look at it, and sure. And that's a pretty easy diagnosis to make in your primary's office.
John, got to let you go. Okay, we're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back to talk to Robert in Saratoga.
Support comes from Adirondack Oral Surgery, Albany, Clifton Park, and Glens Falls, offering a range of oral and maxillofacial surgery, including wisdom teeth extraction, dental implants, oral pathology, and more. AdirondackOralSurgery.com. Innovative Therapy Solutions, a therapy and wellness practice now offering acupuncture for children, teens, and adults to relieve stress, anxiety, depression, and chronic pain. Information available at 413-528-8888. Barrington Stage Company, Pittsfield, Massachusetts, presenting A Doll's House Part 2, a decidedly modern comedic sequel to Ibsen's A Doll's House, July 12th through 28th, barringtonstageco.org. Act Smart New York, Saratoga Springs, offering individualized outpatient counseling and Suboxone treatment for opioid use disorder and medical treatment for alcohol problems. ActSmartNewYork.com. And from Landis Arboretum, Esperance, New York, offering plant collections, hiking trails, old growth forest, concerts, classes, and more, LandisArboretum.org.
And we are back, and we're turning the corner with a wonderful surgeon, Mark Sanchez of Ellis Hospital. And we do hope that you'll call 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551, your show. We'd love to hear from you. Let's go to Robert in Saratoga Springs. Robert, you're on.
Hi, Dr. Sanchez. Interested in how I'd go about finding the best doctor for a esophageal hernia. I'm told that I have a large hiatal hernia, which I'm thinking from what I've read online is an esophageal hernia. I've had an endoscopy and a barium swallow, which then I was referred to a surgeon. Surgeon had I think it's called a motility study, which I've had done, and a CT scan. And I'm waiting to go back for that follow-up appointment with the surgeon. But in the meantime, I saw a cardio specialist who just sort of qualified me for surgery because I'm 79. And he happened to comment, I was asking him the question, I'm asking you how to go about finding someone, and he said it is a complicated surgery and there's a lot that could go wrong. So it makes me all the more interested in finding someone who's especially qualified to do this.
Sure. I think for any surgery, I think it's important to ask your surgeon how many of these cases a year do you do and what are your outcomes? And you're not going to offend someone. It's important to ask that, and they expect to hear that.
Okay.
They're doing all the right things. So all the tests that you had, if a surgeon's not ordering those tests, they really shouldn't be doing that type of surgery. Right.
Okay.
The reason
he also commented that it might not be done laparoscopically because he said it's difficult to repair the hernia that way, perhaps under the circumstances that he senses that I have. But that gives me pause too because I know it's a lot more difficult recovery.
Right. Yeah. So most of these hernias are fixed laparoscopically. So again, another question for your surgeon is, how many of these do you do a year? How many are laparoscopic? And how many do you have to convert to open? Just for the audience, in case they're not familiar with hiatal hernias, hiatal hernia is when you have a defect or a hole in your diaphragm and part of your stomach herniates through the diaphragm into your chest. And in some cases, it's your entire stomach sitting behind your heart. And in other cases, it's a small part. And so, Robert, what kind of symptoms do you have?
Well, I have silent reflux, so I guess I'm lucky that way. But I do get shortness of breath working around the yard. I do a lot of that, and nowhere near the stamina that I used to have. And I can't deal with my CPAP machine very well because my nose gets stuffed up, and it's a complication too. I wanted to ask you if the answer he gives me about the number of surgeries that he does, what should I hope to hear? And if I don't hear it, where do I go from there?
Yeah, you know, there's not a magic number. You know, these are not cases that you're doing 10 a week. I don't think there's anyone in the country that does that many of these. But at least 2 to 3 a month. Two would be reasonable. You know, I think if you're doing 20, 30 a year, I think that's a fair number. And, and you know, again, what are your conversion rates from laparoscopic to open? You also have to be realistic about the expectations, right? So if your preoperative symptoms are not terrible, you know, there are, you had mentioned earlier that you heard there are things that can go wrong. Well, what are the more common symptoms? Well, to fix this hernia, they have to pull your stomach back down below your diaphragm. And then that hole that's in your diaphragm, you need one because that's where the esophagus comes through, but you have to tighten that hole up so that the stomach's not going to just go right back into your chest.
Right.
To help recreate that what we call lower esophageal sphincter, that's that what keeps the acid in your stomach so that it can't go up into the esophagus, they wrap part of your stomach around the esophagus. It's called a Nissen fundoplication, and there's different variations of that. All those studies that you had are to tell a surgeon how well does your esophagus squeeze, how much of your stomach's in your chest, because those are factors that affect how easy or how difficult your operation is going to be. Now, there are some cases you go in laparoscopically and you can't pull that stomach down. The esophagus has become short over time. Well, maybe you have to convert to open. But, you know, they should look at that scan together with you, giving an idea of how much of the stomach's there. And if it's not a, you know, your entire stomach's in your chest, that's usually something that is pretty routinely accomplished laparoscopically. Patients tend to do pretty well and oftentimes can come off of their omeprazole or Nexium or whatever medications they were taking before.
Yeah, that's what I've been taking.
Yep.
Hey, doctor, thank you very much.
You're
Appreciate
welcome.
It.
Good luck, Robert.
All right.
Thanks.
Which is interesting because, you know, there are those of us who have been faced with stopping those medications that you've just mentioned. And then the question is whether or not you should have the operation. And I have to tell you, the GI guys seem to be on one side and the surgeons seem to be on the other side. What can you tell
me
about
that?
Know,
I'm kind of the camp. If you could take one pill a day or two pills a day and avoid an operation and that causes good symptom relief, I think that's great.
Mm-hmm.
That's why I really don't do these operations very often. But within the last couple of years, there's some concern with long-term use of Prilosec and Nexium.
Indeed, there is.
Kidney issues and some calcium issues and bone fracture risks. So, you know, nothing we do in medicine, whether it's a surgery or a medication, is risk-free. And I think you have to weigh out the risk of the operation versus the risk of the medication and see what's right for you.
Do you ever have to work on gunshot wounds?
No, I did my residency in Philadelphia, and there was one night between 9 p.m. and 6 a.m. we did 18 gunshot wounds.
No. What do you have to do when somebody gets shot?
Well, it depends where they're shot.
Let's say you get shot in the arm.
Oh, in the arm? Well, as long as it doesn't hit a nerve or a blood vessel, you're probably okay, right?
Yeah.
So if the bullet goes in and goes right through,
yeah,
and you check the pulses, and those are fine. Sometimes those people don't even need to stay in the hospital. You just clean up the wound and send them home on an antibiotic. But if a major nerve or blood vessel is injured, that's when it becomes more risky. If they're shot in the belly, well, there's lots of things in there that bullet could hit. So those usually require exploration.
Yeah, so you do what? You when you say exploration.
So it's opening up the abdomen while they're asleep under general anesthesia and looking and see what the damage is.
Right? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, a CAT scan's probably not a great place to put a gunshot wound patient.
But there's some things you can't do, right? I mean, in other words, if somebody gets shot in the in the backbone.
Sure.
That would be a difficult operation for you, wouldn't it?
Well, and then result in spinal cord injuries and things like that. What you really want to do in the operating room is rule out something that's life-threatening. So is there a major bleeding or is there contamination because the small bowel was injured or the colon has a hole in it?
Mm-hmm.
So you're going in, and sometimes if people are unstable, you do what's called damage control surgery. It's clean up the mess, fix the holes, resuscitate the patient in the ICU, fluids, antibiotics, and then come back and put everything back together. So every case is different. All depends on how stable someone is. You know, in Philadelphia, a lot of those gunshot wounds were young, healthy patients.
So does your experience as a deputy sheriff help you?
No, and luckily I worked in a very nice area, so we didn't have too much of that.
Let's go to Bobby in Saratoga. Bobby, you're on. Oops, Bobby is not on. Don't ask me what happened, but he's gone. Okay, telephone number here, just in case you're not Bobby, is 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. Well, now when you get called down to the emergency room, and now these are not pre-planned, but you have to react really quickly, what are the ones you really don't want to see?
Well, that's a good question. You know, what we see maybe once a week, twice a week, perforated intestines, perforated large bowel. Diverticulitis is very common. There's two terms, and people often get confused what the difference is between the two. Diverticulosis
and
diverticulitis. Anything in medicine with itis at the end means inflammation of whatever part was before that. So
and osis?
Osis is just pockets on your colon. And it's more common in folks who have chronic constipation issues. And if one of those little pockets gets infected, you get diverticulitis. So that, unlike appendicitis, usually will present with left lower quadrant pain, constant pain, same type of symptoms, constant fevers, chills. That's something you want to bring to the attention of your primary doc because they don't always require surgery. Sometimes it's antibiotics, but the longer you wait to get looked at, sometimes they'll progress, and then that's when we get involved.
So. Cool. Okay, let's go to Kathy. All right, Kathy on line one. You're there, Kathy. Go ahead.
Hello.
Hi, Kathy.
Oh, hi. Is this a doctor?
This is.
Oh, hello, doctor. Thank you for the call. Abdominal hernia. My sister-in-law, she won't go to the doctors about it. She lays down, and when she goes to do a sit-up, you can see that bulge right in the middle. Is that what they look like?
Yeah. You know, there's something called rectus diastasis that sometimes will look like a hernia. And patients will come in, and they almost always say the same thing. When I sit up, it looks like an alien's popping out. And what that is thinning of the abdominal wall. So right above the belly button, between your sternum, the breastbone, and the belly button, you'll get this large bulge. That may not be a hernia.
What do you call it? Spell it.
It's called rectus diastasis.
Spell it, please.
R-E-C-T-U-S. And you're going to test me on this one. D-I-A-S-T-A-S-I-S. And that's not dangerous because the tissue doesn't have a hole in it. And if there's no hole in your abdominal wall, there's not a place for your intestines to go and get trapped. It's more of a cosmetic issue. So oftentimes,
and when she walks, she says she feels pulling in there.
Yeah, you know, sometimes
for years, at least 20.
You just want to see your primary or your surgeon to make sure that there's not a true hernia there. But
she did see the doctor. He's the one that said hernia, but she was a physician assistant. But she just said, if you ever have pain, make sure you let me know and let it go.
Yeah, no, a CAT scan can easily differentiate, but a surgeon should be able to tell the difference between rectus diastasis and a hernia.
Okay, Kathy, thank you. And now we'll go to Elaine in Wilbraham. All right, Elaine in Wilbraham, you're on.
Hi, thank you for the call. I have had trouble with varicose veins and finally had a ligation quite a while ago, and it was doing well until I had double abdominal hernias that I had surgery on. Would that have been the thing that interfered with the surgery I had prior for the ligation?
No, I can't think of any reason why that would cause your varicose veins to flare up again. You know, sometimes...
Oh, really?
Sometimes, I guess, if your mobility is a little bit different after an abdominal operation because you're in some pain, in the course of recovering, could that play some role? But I can't think of anything in the belly that could be done that would contribute to the varicose veins. You know, varicose veins are where the valves that are trying to pump the blood from your foot back up to your heart against gravity, those valves don't work well. So the blood leaks back down and those veins swell as a result. So
at 89, nothing works well.
No, you know, sometimes the simplest thing is the best thing,
no,
right?
I'm
so compression stockings.
Doing well. I am in this heat index when it is hot and humid, having much, much problem with my breathing. And I've also recently had a lot of problem with my hiatal hernia, but I do also have pulmonary and heart difficulties too. But recently, the breathing has gotten much worse. Could it be the hiatal hernia?
It depends on the size of the hiatal hernia.
Elaine, I am so sorry, but we got more people on the phone, and we're almost out of time. Thank you so much
for calling. Thank you so much.
Bye-bye. We'll go to Tom on the Massachusetts Pike. Tom, you're on.
Hello.
Go ahead.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
I'm doing fine. I'm just calling about my wife, who had an operation in January on her hip, and they put 3 pins in. She broke the hip. It was a minor crack, apparently, but she's been having pain ever since. So I'm looking for a second opinion and a doctor. Can you tell me how many operations a year would be reasonable to find a good doctor?
You know, just like in general surgery, we each have our particular area of interest. In regards to orthopedic surgeons, some of them focus strictly on hands, and some only do hips. So, you know, your primary doc who makes those referrals for you oftentimes will have an idea who the good hip person is or who the good hand surgeon is. I would probably rely on on your primary doc to give you that recommendation, but those numbers vary. I think you just want to find someone who, again, does this operation frequently.
Well, thank you. I have to tell you, I did do exactly that, and I found a doctor who I do like. However, people are telling me that in Boston, the Baptist Hospital is the specialist in hip operations. I'm wondering whether I shouldn't just check them out.
Yeah, you know, it's not bad to get a second opinion. But, you know, the operation is the same whether it's in New York or whether it's in Texas, usually, right? So, you know, I get this question frequently when you have a cancer patient. They go, should I go down to MD Anderson, which is a big cancer center, or Memorial Sloan Kettering, or Brigham and Women's? And I say, you know, for your particular straightforward type of cancer, we all treat it the same way.
Thank you, Tom. Okay, and we're going to Richard now in Claverack. Okay, Richard in Claverack, you're on.
Yes, thank you for your time. I was wondering, during surgery for an inguinal hernia, is it possible I have a hydrocele on one side and a hernia on the other? Is that possible?
Yeah, and sometimes hydroceles and hernias are related. So,
yeah, but it's on the opposite side, and they appeared at different time periods, so they're not the same side. That was my curiosity.
So before a male is born, his testicle was in his abdomen. And as he's getting ready to be born, the testicle travels through the inguinal region and down into the scrotum. If that little tunnel that the testicle traveled through, it's called the process vaginalis, if that tunnel doesn't completely close, fluid will go from the belly through that tunnel into your scrotum. So that's called a communicating hydrocele. Now, if that tunnel closes and there's just fluid in the scrotum around the testicle, that's a non-communicating hydrocele. So hydroceles can be associated with inguinal hernias. If you had a hernia on one side, you're a little bit higher risk than the average person for having a hernia on the other side, just because of the
Which
same
is
process.
The case. Yeah.
Yeah, but
I had on the same side that I had the hydrocele, is where I had a hernia done back, 40 years ago.
Yeah, and if it's just fluid there and it doesn't cause you a lot of problems, there's no reason to really do anything with it. But
would you remind us what a hydrocele is one more time?
It's just a pocket of fluid around the testicle.
Oh, I see.
So you'll get some scrotal swelling. It may be a little uncomfortable if it's large enough. But whether or not it communicates with a hernia, it's important to differentiate that, because hernias are a little bit more urgent than a hydrocele by itself. That's relatively asymptomatic.
Well, Richard, thank you.
Yeah, do you need a CAT scan to do that?
No, they can sometimes do that with an ultrasound.
Richard, thanks for calling. We're out of time. And I want to thank Dr. Mark Sanchez of Ellis Hospital for being with us today. Support for the Medical Monday comes from WMC Heart and Vascular Institute, with new diagnostic cardiology suites at Mid-Hudson Regional Hospital and Health Alliance Hospital, members of the Westchester Medical Center Health Network, WMCHealth.org. Thanks to our engineer, the incomparable Zach Malloy. Thanks to Joe Makowitz for answering the phone. Our producer is Jim Lavoulis. I'm Alan Chartok. Thanks again for joining us on the Vox Pop. Stay tuned now for a news update.